This morning, we continue our series of messages entitled One-on-One, Jesus' Interaction with Individuals. Over the last several weeks, we have seen how Jesus interacted not just with the crowds. Yes, there were times when he preached to dozens, hundreds, even thousands. But it's those individual interactions that we see throughout the Gospels that I believe speak to us, because we're not all going to have the opportunity to speak to hundreds or thousands, but we all can deal with one. One at a time is often the way Jesus ministered, and that's, I believe, the most effective way we minister. And that's something every single one of us can do. Now, through these interactions, we find people in different situations. And how Jesus handled them, I think, is very instructive for us. So today we turn to the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John. And this morning my message is entitled, Jesus and the Insignificant. Now, understand when I say insignificant, that's with quotation marks around the word. This man that we're going to be introduced to is certainly not insignificant. And the people he represents today are not insignificant, but they're often treated as insignificant by the world, and sadly, even by Jesus' followers. Few things in life are as heartbreaking as a disability, especially a birth defect. Disabilities break into life in various forms and at various stages. Might be the product of a genetic misalignment in the womb, the result of a tragic accident or trauma, byproduct of infectious diseases or medical events such as a stroke, or from the degenerative effects of old age. Disabilities may affect joints, bones, nervous system, the lungs, the heart, the brain. And even in the United States, country that leads the world in medical technology and innovation, roughly 20% of our citizens live with a disability. One of those disabilities that affects many is blindness. It was reported a number of years ago that in the United States, somebody goes blind every 20 minutes. Though various agencies have differing standards as to what constitutes blindness, all agree that it continues to be a problem in modern times. And even if it may not be complete blindness, but vision problems are cropping up more and more in younger and younger people. And they think a lot of that is overexposure to screen time with phones and computers. Blindness was also common in Jesus' day. And it was often the result of a birth defect or infection. Leprosy could cause blindness. Cataracts, just like many suffer from today. But the prospects for the blind in his day were much less than what we see in our own day. Most were relegated to beg for money from others just to survive. And it's that kind of individual we're introduced to in John chapter 9. We see in that chapter, John chapter 9, verse 1, as Jesus went along, he saw a man that was blind from birth. So we know that this was some kind of genetic malfunction. At no point in this man's life had he ever been able to see. He was born blind. Now, the interaction between this man and Jesus' disciples, and the Jewish leaders take up the entire chapter. And I think we learn from each of these interactions. Sometimes it's what not to do. And then as we look at Jesus, we see how do we deal with those with disabilities? Those many consider insignificant. I want to first consider the attitudes towards the disabled. First, we encounter the disciples. Notice verse 2. The disciples asked Jesus, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" They display the attitude of calloused curiosity. The disciples did not look at this man as an object of mercy, but rather the subject of a theological discussion. Because it's much easier to discuss an abstract subject like sin than it is to minister to the concrete needs of a life of a person. For them, the blind man was an unsolved riddle to be figured out rather than a sufferer to be relieved. And it's easy to become calloused as we see people in need. The disciples may have come along and said, "Oh, case number 321. Here's another one, Jesus." And if you see enough of them along the road, you may become callous to their needs. We have come once again in our country to a time when many will beg at street corners or in Walmart parking lot or wherever you might be. You see them, and after a while, they all look the same, don't they? Once you start passing them by, it gets easier and easier to do so. Or maybe they become matter of inner debate. Maybe we don't talk about it to somebody else, or maybe we do. "Oh, I wonder what got them there. Wonder if it was an addiction to drugs or alcohol, or I wonder if, you know, what happened that they're in this state. I wonder what they would do with my money if I gave it to them," which is a real convenient way not to give. It's easy to become calloused and to become curious. Why are they in the state that they're in? You know, they did more than just treat this man with curiosity. Max Lucado observes, "Never mind that the man is a beggar in need of help. Never mind that this man has spent his entire life in a dark cave. Never mind that the man seated in front of them is in earshot of their voices. Let's talk about his sin. Whose sin was it that caused this blindness?" And we think, how could they be so harsh, so insensitive, so blind? The answer, and you may not like it, it's easier to talk about a person than it is to help them. It's easier to debate homosexuality than to be a friend to a gay person. It's easier to discuss divorce than to reach out to someone who's divorced. It's easier to argue abortion than it is to support an orphanage. It's easier to complain about the welfare system than it is to help the poor. In short, it's easier to label than it is to love. And that's what the disciples were doing. See, they didn't put the label "blind man" on him. They put the label "sinner." Because it must have been some sin. I wonder what sin he committed. To which I'm thinking, in the womb? Seriously? How could he have sinned if he was born this way? But believe it or not, the Jewish rabbis had in their arguments that a fetus could sin within the mother's womb. And the arguments went on and on and on about why. Why did this happen? What is the reason for this man's blindness? As we're going to see later, there's a more important subject we should be pursuing. But they were curious. And in their curiosity, they became calloused. And they were wondering, whose sin caused this disability? Notice Jesus' response in verse 3. "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." I think Jesus is really saying here, guys, quit trying to find the cause. Quit trying to assign blame. This isn't a whodunit that you got to figure out. That's not your responsibility. That's above your pay grade. Leave that one to God. He's the one that can take care of those things. Again, don't focus so much on the reason why they're in the state they're in. Focus on the purpose God has for their life. Because those are two very different things. Oh yes, there's a reason. There's a reason everything happens. And with our technology today, oftentimes if a person suffers from a disability, we can diagnose it. We can figure out, is this a genetic problem? Is this a result of trauma? Is this a result of disease? Is this simply a result of old age? And sometimes when we find the reason, we're better able to treat it. But most of us aren't doctors. Most of us aren't scientists. Most of us aren't in the business of fixing people. So is it really any of our business why this happened? Face it, does it really matter? If you are able to figure it out, how's that going to help them? So our focus ought to be on God's purpose rather than the reason for the disability. And what is God's purpose? Simply put, it is to display His glory by dispensing His grace. And you see, that is the purpose for every single individual who's ever been conceived. To display His glory by dispensing His grace. I'm not saying that God caused this man to be born blind so that after many years His glory could be displayed by removing the blindness. I think to say that would insult the character of God. It does mean that God overruled the disaster of this child's blindness so that not only when he grew to manhood could he receive his physical sight, but the first person he'd ever see was Jesus. And he would receive spiritual vision as well. If you break it all down, all the disabilities and disasters of our world ultimately come from sin. It might be our sin, it might be other sin, it might be original sin, but sin is the ultimate root. Answer solved. There goes our curiosity. But it's not for us to assign guilt. It's not for us to assign blame. It doesn't do any good. The person is still in their condition. Donald Gray Barnhouse writes, "We must ever realize that there are no pat answers for sickness and suffering in the world. There are those who try to tell us that it is God's will for everyone to be healthy. And the only reason a person is not healthy is his lack of faith or sin." And that is sheer nonsense. There are those that will say, "Oh, are you disabled? Well, if you have enough faith, God will heal you." The catch is, if you're not healed, then it's your fault. There's a theological term for that. Some of you are familiar with it. Hogwash. It's simply not true. Speaking of sheer nonsense, the Pharisees enter the scene after Jesus had healed the blind man, and their attitude could be called contemptible cynicism. Notice in verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he doesn't keep the Sabbath. He doesn't play by our rules, so he can't be right. We can't acknowledge him because he doesn't agree with us." They didn't even see the man at all. In fact, they tried to use the man to get to Jesus. And when they realized they couldn't do it, they kicked him out of the temple. To them, he was just a tool, just like the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8 that we looked at last week. They didn't care 2 cents about that woman. They don't care about this man either. If they can't fit into their little theology and their little plot to get Jesus, we have no use for him. Get out. Unfortunately, those are the attitudes we see a lot of people have today. Some are curious and they're wondering why. Others are cynical. Ugh. More people we've got to support. More people leeching off the system. And they cease to become people. They just become things. And that's where we turn to Jesus' attitude, what I would call compassionate concern. Notice when the disciples asked who sinned, he said, verse 3, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. For one thing, he called him a man. He acknowledged his humanity. And he said, he's not the answer to your riddle. He's a human being. And as we're going to see when we get to Jesus' actions regarding him, he treated him as such. So these are the attitudes that people often take toward the disabled. You can look at them with calloused curiosity or contemptible cynicism. Or we could be like Jesus and look at them with compassionate concern. Now let's move to the actions toward the disabled. Again, we begin with the disciples. They avoided the obvious. Here is a man who can't see. Because he can't see, he can't work. Because he can't work, he has no way to support himself. He is at the liberty of others' generosity and goodness. And I don't see one thing the disciples did to alleviate the man's problem. I don't think they put any coins in his cup. They didn't even ask Jesus to heal him. And he's standing right there, right? Hey, Jesus, this guy's blind. Why don't you heal him? Never entered their mind. They're too busy with the questions they have. They avoided the obvious. Say, yeah, but they're not Jesus. They couldn't just say, zap, you know, be healed. They could have done something. Maybe we can't fix people's disability, but we can certainly do something to alleviate their suffering. And maybe that's different for each one of us. Not everybody can write a check to help an individual or some organization that's ministering to them. Maybe it's volunteering time. Maybe it's just getting to know them. You ever notice nobody asked this guy's name? We don't know his name. Nobody bothered to find out. Treat him like a human being. Realize they have more needs than just the obvious need. Oftentimes, the disabled are very lonely. Because people who aren't disabled, well, I don't know what to say. I might say the wrong thing. So we say nothing at all. We just avoid them. We ignore them. The disciples avoided the obvious. Then jumping ahead again to the Pharisees, they assailed the obstacle. They attacked him. When he wouldn't go along with their plot to trap Jesus, get out of here. We have no use for you. And that can happen a lot today too. You know, we might do something special for the disabled if it shines a light on us, but if we're not getting the props and we're not getting the pats on the back, then we don't need it. Who are we really ministering to at that point? But Jesus took a different direction. He addressed the ordeal. He proceeded to cure the man. And notice what he says even before he did it. Verse 4, as long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Here is Jesus, the light of the world, dispelling the darkness. And he says, we've got work to do. And notice, he doesn't say, as long as it is day, I must do the work. He says, we must do the work. And I think that qualification is very important because he says, as long as, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Guess what, folks? He's not in the world today. Jesus is in heaven at the right hand of God. But do you know what Jesus said elsewhere in Scripture? You are the light of the world. You, my followers, you are the light of the world. Now, we're not the light in the same way Jesus is. I think a great illustration of this is the relationship between the sun and the moon. The sun produces light. Being a star, it generates light. The moon does not. The moon has no light-generating properties of itself. What it does is reflects the light of the sun. So that at night, while the sun is on the other side of the world from us, and we can't see the sun, we can see the light of the sun shining off the moon. And that's what we are. We are to reflect the light of the sun, S-O-N, in our dark world. And we are to do the work of Him who sent Jesus. Not debate about it, not talk about it, not argue as to why this happened or who's to blame. What can we do about it? And that's a challenge that we are faced with as well. Jesus did something about it. By dispensing the grace of God, He displayed the glory of God in this man's life. He gave back his sight. And God does the same thing with regard to the disabled today, though not always in the same manner. He doesn't always choose to take away the disability. In this case, He did. But when Paul cried out 3 times to take away a thorn in the flesh, God said, "No, I'm not taking it away, but My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in your weakness." So that when people see what I do in your life, they're going to say, "Well, that couldn't have been that guy. It has to be someone else." So sometimes God chooses to heal and He gets the glory. Sometimes He chooses not to heal, but He gives us His grace. And either way, it is God addressing the ordeal in our lives. Sometimes He heals physically. Sometimes He heals emotionally. Sometimes He heals spiritually. Sometimes this change is instantaneous, as it is with this man. Sometimes it may take months or even years. But it's all to the glory of God, and it's all by the grace of God. I want to conclude this morning by seeing the applications regarding the disabled. First, regarding the disabled among us. Perhaps you have been agonizing over the reason for your disability. You've asked yourself, "Why, God? Are you angry with me? Did I do something to deserve this?" The answer is you may not know the reason this side of heaven. And unless the Lord convicts you of a certain thing that you need to repent of, don't get too caught up in the why. But rather say, "Lord, what do you want me to do? How do you want your glory to shine through me? Is it through healing? Or is it through persevering in faith in spite of my disability?" Either way, God is glorified. And remember, His grace is sufficient for you. For those who are not physically disabled, let's learn from the disciples and the Pharisees what not to do. Don't label them. Don't make them a matter of theological or philosophical or political debate. Remember that first and foremost, you are dealing with a person, a man or woman created in the image of God for whom Christ died. First and foremost, every individual you encounter fits that bill. And that makes them worthwhile. That makes them worth your time and attention. That makes them worth your efforts to alleviate their suffering, however the Lord may lead you to do it. We may not have the power to heal, but we all have the power to help. And I believe we're all called to do so. And then finally, I believe the healing of the blind man here could also be understood as a parable of spiritual illumination. You know, even more profound than this man's physical lack of sight was the spiritual blindness of the people around him. Jesus uses this as a powerful object lesson that the whole world is in darkness, just as this man was physically. They are spiritually in darkness, but he is the light of the world. And so what I'd like to do in closing is maybe to understand spiritual blindness through some common factors that affect our physical sight. The first is nearsightedness. A nearsighted person can't see things far away. That's me. I've been nearsighted since I was in third grade and wearing these things ever since. Mine is so bad that without these, I can't read the print right there. And I certainly can't see you. I'm probably legally blind without these. But what does that mean spiritually? Spiritual nearsightedness occurs when a person is so wrapped up in their own situation they can't see beyond it. It's reflected in the words of Psalm 40, verse 12. For troubles without number surround me. My sins have overtaken me, and I cannot see. Literally says it. I can't see past the troubles, my own sin. I can't see beyond it. Now, the prescription for spiritual nearsightedness is twofold. Isaiah 40, 26 says, lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Quit looking at yourself. Look to God. And then secondly, Jesus said in John 4, 35 and 36, do not say 4 months more and then the harvest. I tell you, open your eyes. Look at the fields. They are ripe unto harvest. And he wasn't saying get the combines out because the corn and beans are ready to go. He was saying spiritually, the harvest is ready. Open your eyes. Look to the fields. Because spiritual nearsightedness is looking only within. Now on the other side, you have farsightedness. These are folks who can't see things up close. These are the ones who, when they're at the restaurant, their arms aren't long enough to get the menu out there so they can see, right? Some of you understand that by experience. Spiritually speaking, farsightedness is seeing everybody else's problems, but we're blind to our own. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7, verse 3, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye when you've got a plank in your own? How can you say, here, let me get that speck of sawdust out of your eye when you got a plank sticking out of your own eye? Take the plank out of your eye, and then you can see to take the speck out of your brother's eye. He was addressing spiritual farsightedness. Then there's cataracts. I know some of you here have dealt with cataracts. They're cloudy lenses that block vision. Cataracts are the leading cause of blindness today. Spiritual cataracts are represented in Isaiah 6, verses 9 and 10. The Lord said to Isaiah, go and tell these people, be ever hearing but never understanding. Be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused. Make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears and understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. Notice the calloused condition here. And that's what cataracts, they're like calluses over your eyes. And they need to be removed. And only the Spirit of God can do that for our spiritual vision. Then there's night blindness. Some folks just can't see at night. And we see in Matthew 6, 22, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Spiritual night blindness keeps us from seeing the light. And the light of the world is Jesus. It tempts many Christians to give up, to conclude that there's no hope for themselves or for the world. But to such, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 4:16, "Therefore we do not lose heart. We do not give up. Though outwardly we are wasting away, inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes, not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." That last phrase brings me to the last correlation, and that's being cross-eyed. Some people are born cross-eyed. Others with normal vision can sometimes cross their own eyes. I had an experience with this once, unwittingly. There is a picture of my brothers and I, and we're all gathered around a microphone on a stand. We're just goofing around before a wedding. And we posed like we were singing into the microphone, you know, in a studio. And my brothers are on either side, and I'm right in the middle, and I'm looking at the microphone, so when they snap the picture, my eyes are crossed. It can be that simple. But unlike the other analogies of physical vision ailments with spiritual counterparts, I would say being spiritually cross-eyed is a good thing when we fix our eyes on Jesus. Fix your eyes on Him. Hebrews 12:2 says, "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith." Fix your eyes on Him. May the cross always be in our vision. Because when we see the world through the cross of Jesus, people are no longer labels. They're no longer points of a debate. They're no longer a nuisance. They're not a parasite to be destroyed and done away with because they inconvenience me, because they're sucking the life of our economy. They're people, and they're people who deserve to live. They're people who deserve life. They're people who deserve to know the Savior. When we fix our eyes on Jesus, it corrects all of our vision problems, and we see the world and other people differently. And so my challenge to you this morning, maybe we need to take a spiritual eye exam. Where are we? Are we nearsighted? Are we farsighted? Do we suffer night blindness or cataracts? May we all be cross-eyed in the sense that we focus on Jesus. Fix our eyes on Him. Everything else will come into focus.